Freedom of speech.
For all speech synthesizers.
This is the Serotalk Podcast Network.
Comments made on the Serotalk Podcast Network are those of the individuals and do not represent Serotech Corporation, its staff, management, board of directors, or third-party reseller.
And welcome to This Month in Access Technology for August 2011. This is Michael Loff. Our guests this evening are Kelly Ford. He is a long-standing Access Technology specialist, currently employed with Microsoft, and in that position currently does not do anything specifically with accessibility. Thank you, Kelly, for joining us this evening.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
Also, you've heard him before on our podcast, Mr. Jeff Bishop. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me here.
Yes, and you work with the University of Arizona. You're a developer out there, and you have a website. I was looking here. You have jeffbishop.com.
Yep, and then my scripting side of things is done at csedesigns.com, and I do a lot of WindowEyes scripting. Actually worked for Microsoft many eons ago, too.
Our third guest tonight is Wade Wingler. He is the Director of Assistive Technology for Easter Seals Crossroads, located in Indianapolis, Indiana. Thanks for joining us tonight, Wade.
Hey, guys. Glad to be here.
So you have EasterSealsTech.com. You're on Twitter as INDataProject. IN is in Indiana, so INDataProject. And you just recently started your own podcast.
Yeah, that's right. We do one called Assistive Technology Update every week. Cut my teeth on the job accommodation and some screen reader scripting and things years ago, but alas, have been elevated to the point of budgets and meetings and strategic planning. So many, many of my hours of my day spent in management, but still do a lot with assistive technology.
But Apple has launched iPhone 5. With AT&T, Verizon, and Sprint in October. So my question would be, first of all, do you think having that third competitor, some lower prices, better plans?
If anything, I think Sprint will try to make themselves stand out in the crowd for a while and do what everyone else has done and offer an unlimited data plan. Now, I think they'll soon learn, though, that their network may or may not be able to withstand the growth that's going to provide them, you know, as far as an opportunity. And so it'll be interesting to see if it sticks. As for pricing, you know, I don't think so. I think the pricing models that we're seeing today are going to remain. I think, you know, all the players are pretty much cemented in what they're going to charge. Who knows what Sprint will do. I'm on AT&T, and I'm eligible to upgrade to the iPhone 5, but it's going to have to really be something remarkable to consider that. Not to say that I won't do it in a year, but, you know, buying a square trade warranty, you know, sort of throwing money away when you, you know, upgrade too early.
Well, you know, this is Wade, and I've been using an iPhone for a long time. And quite frankly, where I am in Indiana, I had forgot that Sprint was even a player in the game here. The only person I know is a good friend who's been a big evangelist for Sprint system for years, and he finally switched to an iPhone and to AT&T just about a year or so ago just to get his hands on the hardware. So I'm not sure that it's going to matter a whole lot for Sprint. From my perspective, they've kind of been fading away, and with AT&T and T-Mobile looking to join up, I'm not sure that's even going to matter.
Well, it'll be interesting now that the Department of Justice has said, no, we don't approve this. Can it still happen? The FCC hasn't made up their mind. And there's already talk, if that doesn't go through, that they'll divvy up T-Mobile to a few different entities. But AT&T is certainly not going to go down without a fight. And that's one of the questions, and maybe I should ask that now. If that were to happen, if AT&T did acquire T-Mobile and we only have one GSM option in the U.S., do you think that the government should stay out of it and let the industry self-regulate? Or do you think that there needs to be involvement and that is bad for consumers to have only one entity for GSM, which is a global technology for phones?
Well, you know, I think self-regulation presents with some challenges, but I think mostly folks don't want their calls to drop. I think mostly are looking for that coverage. And so I think people want the experience. I think they want good service. And if that means one provider, I think some folks may be okay with that.
Well, I think people are used to one provider. I mean, you look at cable television providers and even electric companies and everything else, that's all we have. I would love to be able to get Comcast in my house, but unfortunately, you know, the city has a exclusive deal, you know, with my provider. So I think as long as, you know, the signal can be improved, I don't really see any harm in the merger necessarily. People have said, well, it's really bad for the consumer, but again, I don't see prices changing, and you know, I just don't see it happening. It's too competitive. The data that we're using on these networks is becoming more and more and more. They need the money to be able to build out their infrastructures. I just don't see that it's going to happen now. I think anyway, and it's just a matter of how much concessions AT&T has to make.
Well, we should keep in mind. Go ahead, Kelly.
I was going to say, I think overall, though, what you see across the industry is prices on a lot of these services tend to settle out at fairly similar rates.
Yeah, I had a friend that said that you really don't have competition until you have at least three entities bidding for your business. So we'll see if that third entity makes any difference. But what people need to remember is AT&T, Verizon, and Sprint all sell, you know, bundles of minutes or data to third-party entities. So if you shop around, you can find other technologies, other companies, lesser-known companies that are basically piggybacking. So there are affordable ways. You just have to go beyond the big three to accomplish that. But with that, let's see. What else? I apologize here. I got a few strange little distractions going on here. We found a great guide for Macintosh Lion, and this basically comes from Apple themselves, and they've refined and I think improved the user manual. So I want to ask Wade, from your perspective and position as the program director, what impact tools like Apple, either the iPad 2 or even Macintoshes in general, are they replacing, in some cases, note takers? Are people looking at them in education or employment as a more economical replacement, a mainstream solution?
Well, you know, one of the things that I tend to talk about is what I like to call the appification of assistive technology. And by that, I mean the fact that we have all of this portable hardware and smartphones and cell phones and specifically iOS devices, and the fact that there's, you know, a platform that seems to be a little more ubiquitous and accessible to the general public. And we're seeing lots and lots of that. Not necessarily an assistive technology example, but one that I'm dealing with right now is I have a 14-year-old daughter she's a freshman in high school, and they announced last fall or last spring that there won't be textbooks this year. And we're the first school in Indiana to do that, or the first high school. And they're rolling out almost 1,000 iPads to all the students and staff. And I think we're seeing a whole lot of that in the general education world. And the fact that with the accessibility of iOS, you know, you have screen magnification, you have screen reading built in that is going to hit most of the applications and web-based content they're going to use. Absolutely. I think that platform holds tremendous promise for the field of assistive technology. And it also makes it more more accessible. And I don't mean in the AT way. I mean more accessible to the general public, because everybody is becoming aware of those devices. And of course, you should be able to turn on the accessibility thing. People kind of assume that sort of thing. We're also seeing a whole lot in the field of augmentative communication, you know, those situations where you're using technology to be a person's voice, somebody who has cerebral palsy or Lou Gehrig syndrome and don't talk. We're seeing a whole lot of $8,000 and $10,000 devices being replaced by a few hundred-dollar app, or in many cases a less expensive app, an extended battery pack, a shock guard, and all of a sudden you've got a $500 augmentative communication device instead of something that was much more expensive in the past. So we're seeing a whole lot of that. From my perspective.
Wait, I'd like to comment about that in reference to the books situation. You know, iBooks is really great and everything in reference to accessibility, but most of the other book platforms that are provided, except for CourseSmart, are not accessible. And I am a little bit frightened about that textbooks are going to pretend, you know, depending upon the format of the provider, they will not be accessible. And so I think we really have to push really hard, you know, to be able to, you know, get that to I'm kidding. I need to figure out how I'm going to get these notifications to stop in Boxcar. But, you know, to make sure that books remain accessible to students, because without that, there's no learning that can take place.
Well, and one thing along that front, it happened, I think, a little bit before August, but folks should know, right? Adobe has made a step in the direction with their first efforts at digital editions accessibility.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, Wade, your thoughts on that. That was my first concern, the accessibility of the books. Where are they coming from?
Well, and you know, that's, we're still in this experiment with the school system, and they're starting to answer some of those questions as we move along. And the interesting thing that they said was, in situations where, you know, let's say you've got a 50-chapter science textbook, maybe the teacher isn't crazy about chapters 25 and 26. Maybe web-based content would be used in place of those chapters, or maybe PDF documents or things that may not be necessarily in the context of a digital textbook would be used. And some of the teachers are embracing the idea of, well, if I don't like something in terms of content about the textbook, what other digital resources, what other online content can I use to substitute and get that, and get that that point across? So I think that's one way they're going to deal with the accessibility issues that might be there. And then the other thing, obviously, when we talk about, you know, the NIMA standards and things like that, I don't deal with that every day, but I have to assume that, that that's going to improve some of the accessibility for textbooks, at least in the K-12 environment. And feel free to correct me on that, guys, if you know more about the NIMA standards.
Yeah, just a few other Apple things here. It looks like Apple's offering a buyback program for Macs and iPhones and iPads. I don't know if any of you think you'll participate in that. There's probably, you can make a little more money if you want to go eBay or maybe even Craigslist or other entities that specifically buy Apple products for resale, assuming they're in good condition. But also, this was a big story. It was the departure of Steve Jobs. And will this affect, how will this affect Apple? And some folks, which is something I never even gave thought to, was, will it impact the future of accessibility? Was that really a passion of Steve's, or did that come from somewhere else, just trying to get it into the education system, just like Wade's talking about, you know, getting it implemented into the whole high school, that they made sure that it was accessible? Any thoughts on that?
Well, I don't think that it's going to impact Apple in the next, say, 3 to 5 years, because I think that roadmap's already been cemented. Now, the market could change that, of course, and who knows, but I don't think that we need to worry necessarily about the state of accessibility with Steve, you know, leaving. I think he set up a culture there that, and, you know, and he put in lots of great people, and he knew this day was coming. I mean, obviously, he knew many years ago that his health was not necessarily, you know, the best. So I think things are going to be okay on the Apple front.
Yeah, and this is Wade. I would agree with that. I think that maybe 5 to 6 years down the road, you might start to see some mission drift or things like that related to Apple. But the other thing that I hope keeps accessibility on track is the fact that, you know, age-related disabilities are going to help continue to do that. The fact that my grandparents, who spend half their year in Texas, are thinking about an iPad instead of a laptop for their computer to haul back and forth, and my grandmother has glaucoma, you know, all of a sudden the iPad with magnification becomes a viable option. So, I mean, Apple makes money, right? They've got more money than the government and the recording industry. And if they know that we have a group of baby boomers who are going to need some of those accessibility features, I think they're going to be there. They can't miss that.
Well, also with, you know, the country, the medical people in the country saying that there's going to be probably an additional 30 million people having diabetes coming up here in the next 10 to 20 years in this country, there's going to be a lot more blind people, unfortunately, that are going to need technology. So
we see that the commissioner of the FCC wants to make sure that emergency 911 services have SMS capability and the ability to send text. Do you think this presents any issues? I assume, obviously, you could still pick up the phone and do things the old-fashioned way, so hopefully that's an enhancement. I've never done a lot with video SMS, but that'd be a good thing to take pictures, I guess, of your location, or if it'll have any effect on those with disabilities, or maybe be an enhancement.
I think it could be good for deaf-blind, especially if they have, you know, a Braille display connected to their device, text messages.
Well, and I think that speaks a lot for folks who are deaf as well. You know, having the ability to text in your 911 call when you don't speak on the phone or you have to rely on a relay service is really an important thing. I also hope that that pushes forward the efforts for reverse 911 so that, you know, when there's an emergency, that information can be pushed back out via text message. And additionally, I don't know, if I crash my car and I hurt my leg and I can send a video to the ambulance who's on the way to let them know how bad my leg is hurt, I think that video information is really useful too, whether or not it's a disability thing. I see lots of promise there.
I think it's just all positive. It's going to enable populations that have had to use other channels or you know, third parties to communicate more directly, and it's going to allow for better information for the people that have that ability to send it. I mean, so I see nothing negative about it.
Any thoughts on the wide variety of lawsuits with the different phone manufacturers, one suing the other over patents. And I have some concern because some of the patents are very specific to accessibility. And I have concerns about Apple or some other entity locking up a patent that controls something that is accessible. Any thoughts on that?
Oh my gosh, is all I can say about the patent lawsuit whole situation. Has anybody listened to the This American Life episode that talks about when patents attack? If you haven't had a chance to check that out, it's a great story that talks about this whole big Cold War situation with big companies and their technology patents. I think it's a nightmare. I really do.
Yeah, I'm very concerned about it. And of course, there's been a lot of cases thrown out saying, well, yeah, you have that patent, but when it comes to internet and global technologies, it's not as strong as you think it is. But still, it stifles innovation because legal battles cost quite a bit of money.
Well, I think it hurts the smaller players of any software industry. And I think, especially in this day and age, especially in our field, we need as much innovation as we possibly can get. And so I'm not sure what the solution is. I mean, I understand needing to protect the things that you create. I understand that. But I still think there has to be a way to reform things so that, you don't put other people out of business or potentially put them out of business based on having to protect your entity.
Well, and I think we have a patent system that was originally designed to get people to be more forthcoming, with their innovation and those kind of things. But it's turning into a situation where research dollars are now being diverted to lawsuits. And maybe, a small to medium company, they can't defend themselves against a multi-million dollar lawsuit when those things come their way. But now they're looking at licensing. So, a patent holding firm might come and say, well, I'm not going to sue you for a bazillion dollars, but for, $5 per unit, I'll go ahead and license my technology. And I heard recently that in the patent office, the people who help approve those things aren't technically skilled when they look at software specifically to know if there's overlap. And I believe it was the public radio story that said there's as much as a 30% overlap in patents that are issued. So 30% of the patents have already been issued for something exactly the same or very similar, which is why you have these big competing treasure troves of patents that creates this situation. And it's just really, really stifling the industry. I'm worried about it.
I'm concerned as well. You're right. You got overlapping. You have judges who may not even understand the technologies. It comes down to first come, first serve, interpretations.
Only that, though, Mike. I think it also has to be looked at in reference to what is the harm to the market as a whole if a patent is defended. Look at our industry, for example, the AT industry. I think, there could be very significant harm if any player really got really, really aggressive and potentially put other players out of the business. It would be very stifling for innovation and such in this industry. It would be very difficult.
Well, and that's a really great point, because a lot of the great assistive technology applications were developed for one person, by a family member, and it started off in a really traditional mom and pop garage kind of project. And so, yeah, that's a great point.
But again, people, they have the right to defend what they've created. I think there needs to be a happy medium somewhere. I'm just not sure what it is.
I think, though, you need to really emphasize what you just said, Jeff. I mean, people's intellectual property, is of a value. And there's, as a society, I think we're still sorting this out. But people do, if you invent something, you need to have some protections for that.
Yes, but there also needs to be protections for the people that this technology assists. We already have 70% unemployment of the blind in this country now. If things went really crazy with patent, stuff, how higher could it go? Because businesses would not be able to innovate and be able to provide, opportunities for people. I don't know. It's really a vicious circle. I don't really know what the solutions are, but we have to be able to, reward people for creating solutions to things, but we also need to not stifle, others.
I respect what you're saying, but I think it's a bit of a stretch to say that anything that happens in the patent side of things is going to positively or negatively impact the employment of people who are blind. I'd love, we could talk about that for the next 30 minutes.
Yeah, we could.
I've been hearing that 70% number for a long time, and you know, we've tried a lot of different ways, and it's not really moved the needle so far.
Nope.
Yeah, I mean, I could ask you, Wade, about that, because to me it seems to go back to the quality of training, the education, person's social skills, their ability to integrate into society.
Well, and I think we can all agree that better innovation, you know, easier to use, more solid technology, as well as lower price points is always going to positively affect the employability of people who have disabilities or rely on assistive technology. And I'm not sure that anything happening with the patent wars right now is lowering cost or stimulating a whole lot of innovation.
But I think to talk a little more about that, I mean, you have to look a lot further. I know my personal experience, and prior to working at Microsoft, I actually worked in a college setting. It was a community college, and so a lot of the people that came to our college, they left after 2 years right into jobs. And having worked with a number of people who are blind, you know, the employment factors, it wasn't always about the technology.
Well, it was interesting to me, and I saw this firsthand in one of my gigs, where it was a situation where the fault doesn't fall on the maker of the technology that the company uses. It comes back, you know, to the company. So the company's in a situation, well, this is the only technology we have to use to get the job done, and if it's not accessible, then, well, I guess we can't keep you on the books.
Back in the day, this was a long time ago, I mean, but I've told this story to several people that I've worked with over the years. You know, if we can talk about this for a minute, I mean, I find it an interesting topic. I was looking for a job, and this one company actually, this was in their mid-90s, it was a mortgage company, but they built their thing on top of America Online, and the guy wanted to hire me, but he did whatever he could, you know, let me try every screen reader, all the configuration scripts, whatever you wanted to call it for each screen reader. You know, but we just could never get it to work. And so, you know, that contributes to that 70% number. And that's no fault of that company's.
Indeed. We're about halfway through. I wanted to move on because this was a big announcement, this being Google Plus. And I have a link here that says keyboard accessibility, but those who played with it said it still has quite a ways to go. Have any of you looked at that? Do you feel that's something we need to really be advocating for? Or, you know, when we're talking about employment, a lot of folks using Google Calendar and other Google tools in the work environment.
You know, Mike, this is interesting. I think that before we start seeing a lot of innovation in Google products or even other HTML5-oriented products, I think we need to see a dramatic shift in screen readers today, because right now you have browse mode or a virtual cursor or something, you know, on the Windows side, and it makes it very difficult to be able to get these shortcuts to work. You know, these new hotkeys that are used. In fact, there's a new Google Music beta out, and that has a lot of new shortcuts as well. But you have to make sure you turn off your, you know, browse mode or your virtual cursor to make them work. And so I applaud the work that Google's doing. I think it's fantastic that they're really starting to listen to the community and starting to innovate. I think that's a very, very good thing. But I also really think that there needs to be a significant paradigm shift in the way that screen readers are used on the web today. And I'm not really sure what that innovation is going to look like, but it definitely needs to happen.
Yeah, of course, there's Windows 8 coming out. So if they really change the UI, the way that screen readers interact, we'll talk about that more when we actually when they actually make it available through TechNet and so forth. And even though Kelly is with Microsoft, because of that alliance, he cannot comment on Windows 8 and its development. So all we know is kind of some articles we have up here on the show notes page. There are some different blogs and some folks from Microsoft that have been allowed to comment on it, talking about you know, implementation of the Ribbon and the Windows Explorer and just some other cosmetic changes. And
if I can interrupt just for 1 second or just make one point. I know it's kind of awkward given that I do work at Microsoft, but like Jeff no more represents Arizona. It's Arizona State you work at, Jeff?
Right, and we should comment on that. The folks here, their opinions are their own.
My own, and so just to make sure people understand that.
I was just wanted to state that, Kelly, before we open up for questions and folks say, oh, Microsoft, let me ask him everything I want to know about Windows 8 or why this doesn't work and that doesn't work, that you're, because of that affiliation, not at liberty to comment on Microsoft. I wanted to have disclosure on that. Oh, we just lost someone. Are you there?
Wade's still here.
Okay, we lost someone in particular. Okay, so anyway,
we lost Jeff.
Okay, so we were talking about Google Plus, and just, of course, ACB has done something with Google, and they have a quite lengthy survey that is a little complicated or time-consuming for some that don't want to put quite that much effort into it. Let's move on to this FCC reinstating video description mandates. I guess my first question would be, what do you think about mandates? When are they important, or is this something that we should be trying to work with industry to resolve? Or is there just times that just breaks down and we have to have these federal mandates?
Well, this is what, in my experience, when I've had chance to work with the television industry, you know, in terms of developing program content or you know, buying ads or those kind of things, is the margins within a TV station are pretty slim. A lot of times the people in the back offices are sitting on folding chairs. And so until there's profitability behind adding, you know, those kind of things, I think mandates are going to be absolutely necessary. I think that's going to have to be pushed from a legislative or a prescriptive kind of state, or it's not going to happen if it relies on the TV stations to pay for that out of pocket.
But let's also the individual local TV stations don't have a lot of profit, but the industry and the networks have a fair amount of profit. And I don't work in that business, but the figures I've seen from WGBH for what it costs, for example, the video describe even a full-length feature movie, you know, they probably spend more on donuts for the cast and crew. And it really depends on your philosophy on the government. You know, we've had mandated closed captioning. So I personally don't think that, I think, what are they asking for, 50 hours per quarter?
Yeah, 50 hours per quarter in the major markets, 50 markets.
So, you know, I think it's personally, I think it's a fine thing. I don't think it's going to impose a huge barrier on the people producing the television, the media content. And I recognize that not everyone's a fan of video description or audio description. I love it.
Well, you know, Kelly, that's a great point. I hadn't really thought about the cost of actually doing the video description. My world tends to involve a lot of captioning things for people who are deaf or hard of hearing. And the cost of changing that content over or making that the closed captioning accessible is higher. You know, it takes more to do that. We're looking at possibilities. We do a lot of streamed training on assistive technology and what it's going to cost us per hour to do captioning, and that's an expensive proposition. So, you know, if that's true that the cost of video description is much lower, then maybe it is easier. So that's a great point.
I mean, to be clear, I'm not an expert, so I don't want to talk. I have a number that I seem to recall reading from WGBH, but I'd have to go look it up. I thought I heard him say one time it was like, I don't know. I thought I heard him say it maybe it was like $12,000 a movie, but I'm not, you know, I hate to say that, I just did, but it could be very different. But my impression from them was it wasn't overly expensive.
Well, and they would argue their concerns are with TV shows that are sometimes down to last minute, literally within 24 hours or less. And that adding that component of getting a narrative description in place. I'm still hung up on this fact that...
Oh, sorry, go ahead, Michael.
I'm still hung up on this fact that, wait a minute, as of now, you know, you have captioning, that's great. But when it comes to audio alerts, they can continue and keep the audio from the television program, and the blind community is simply going to have to go grab a weather radio or some AM/FM device to find out what the actual emergencies are. And we're going to talk a little bit about emergency preparedness shortly with all the flooding from Irene and Lee and just the earthquake that hit the East Coast. I'm really concerned about that.
Well, I think another interesting kind of, you know, technical issue that goes along with that is when you're doing closed captioning for folks who are deaf or hard of hearing, that's almost a one-to-one. You know, each spoken word generally, or at least is supposed to, turn up as a printed word. Not so with descriptive video. There's a little more art, I think, than science in that. And so I think consistency among the delivery of that, as well as, you know, who does that, and developing a pool of labor, some people who are, I don't know if you call yourself a descriptive video artist or what when you do that job, but I think there's some ramping up. So I'm glad to see that there are some mandates pushing that forward, and hopefully that's just the beginning of more and more accessibility.
Indeed. We mentioned your emergency preparedness, and I have a variety of links here. And we even did a tech chat number 46, and I was inspired by the book called One Second After that raised, be it fictional, but the real hypothesis of something that basically destroys the power grid and throws us back 150 years. But even with recent, again, the earthquake and flooding and a few hundred thousand people relocated now, do any of you take steps to plan for emergencies in advance? And maybe what would you consider as kind of essential supplies or technologies, or what would you advise if someone came to you with a disability and said, I'm concerned about this. What do I need to have in my arsenal? What do I do? Where do I go? How do I find a Red Cross shelter or get out of town when everyone's trying to do so and there's no flights, no Greyhound? And
well, I think in today's, I mean, right, just a couple hours ago, a big chunk of California, Mexico, and I think parts of Arizona had a big power outage. You know, we've had the hurricanes and all the floods. I think it's incumbent on everybody these days to have a plan for emergency preparedness. You know, it's a lot of the typical things that you hear. Make sure that you have your food, your water, several days' supply of it. I know for myself, when I move to a new area, you know, I go find out, okay, where are the shelters if I have to get to one, and try and talk to a couple neighbors if I need that circumstance, you know, because when it goes bad, usually, I mean, it goes bad in a hurry, and that's not the time that you want to be trying to figure out, wow, where do I go?
And I think there's tons and tons of things that individuals who are blind or visually impaired can do to prepare on a personal level. We've been having conversations lately with both the city of Indianapolis as well as the Indiana Department of Homeland Security. And I had a really unique experience where I got to get in front of, I don't know, these guys were in military uniforms and police and fire, and they were the kind of the top dogs of emergency preparedness for our local area. And I did a half an hour talk on what is assistive technology. You know, I showed them a talking watch, and I showed them a real simple communication device for somebody who's nonverbal. And I showed them an alarm clock that vibrates to wake somebody up instead of relying on audio indications. And their jaws were hitting the floor. The awareness piece among people who work in the emergency preparedness field is a really big deal. And I think one of the first things we can do is try to wake folks up to those needs. And during that conversation, it was great because not only did I get to say, hey, here's how a screen reader works, or, you know, here's some funky, weird keyboards that work on computers that you just plug them in and maybe somebody with cerebral palsy could use it. That awareness piece was good. But then they started asking questions, well, where do we get these tools? We've started kind of a very entry-level conversation about, well, how can we leverage some resources, either, you know, reutilized equipment or putting together some go kits. And one of my personal goals here in Indiana is to try to put together, you know, two or three or four big Pelican cases that are, you know, waterproof, that when there's some sort of an emergency, I can get somebody who's heading that way to pitch one of those on the back of the fire truck, so that when they get there, there's a handheld magnifier, or there's a CCTV, or maybe there's a computer with a screen reader ready to go, so that at the shelter, when they get access to email, somebody who uses a screen reader can do that. Now, the problem, funny enough, I don't think is going to be getting those go kits ready to go and getting the technology. I think I can figure out ways to get that paid for. The big challenge is training, you know, and getting not only the emergency workers to recognize, oh, that person might have a need for assistive technology, whether it's, you know, something for vision or mobility, and then making sure that the technology, once it's deployed there, is been able to be used and supported and things like that. So I think there's a ton that can be done from the personal level. But also, we need to kind of wake up the EMS crowd and the Red Cross and everybody else about what is this stuff, and when should you start pulling those tools out of your toolbox to help folks.
Oh, that's good. Also, the media in general. I saw an iPad today, and it was mainstreamed, and, you know, talking about assistive technologies. And, of course, that was from FLAC when they kind of blew off an AT story or complained about a particular website that was text only. And the comment was something, what about us normal-sighted folks or something like that? So that aroused a lot of resentment. A lot of folks spoke up and said, hey, these tools are very important for all forms of accessibility, blindness, AAC, and so forth. I want to mention this. There's currently an investigation by the GAO, the General Accounting Office. There's talk about cutting SSI checks for children because some parents are giving the children psychotropic drugs because the parents feel they had to do that to qualify for benefits, not only SSI, but also Medicaid to cover the medical costs. I was curious, Wade, if you've ever heard of anything like this happening?
You know, I really haven't, and I know that when we're talking about those kind of disabilities, they really, really are individualized. You're talking about communication, you're talking about behavior, you're talking about how these kids perceive and interact with the world. And so I think it's hard for an organization, a behemoth as big as Social Security, to make sweeping decisions about that. So I'm not surprised there's a little bit of noise there, but I can't say that I've got a lot of experience or information with that particular situation.
I mean, I just recall this situation in high school where there was a parent who basically made every effort to keep her child in that disability status just to get some extra money coming in home. So I know firsthand that it does happen. I hope the very rare and isolated incidents that someone would penalize or, you know, but certainly those services and sometimes the medications are necessary and the folks just don't have the income to make it happen. But we'll track that and see kind of what comes out of it. Here's another story, came out of the Black Hat Security Conference. So I want to ask you if you think we should be concerned about the fact that it's been proven that insulin pumps could be remotely altered or disabled up to as much as 1/2 mile away. By default, maybe 200 feet, but maybe with some modifications up to 1/2 mile away. You know, the talk was, what if someone used this to kill someone for insurance money or something like that?
Personally, I think, you know, it's like any technology, we should understand the security implications because technology in and of itself is just a tool, and people can use it for good or they can use it for bad. And over time, society has shown that if there are ways to do evil with technology, you know, it will happen, and you need to understand that and protect for it.
Well, I'm really glad you brought this one up, Mike, because I am sitting here currently looking at my MiniMed Paradigm insulin pump that I wear, and I've been an insulin pump user for almost 15 years. That doesn't bother me personally, but I think it's because I understand the technology a little bit. Just because if somebody were to hack my insulin pump, well, first they'd have to be kind of close. And secondly, that doesn't mean that I probably wouldn't recognize the signs of hypoglycemia if it happened. So I'm not sure there's a whole lot of danger there to be done. There's usually not a whole lot of instant damage to do to somebody with insulin. But I'll tell you what it does encourage me about it. I'm somebody who's married, and I know that I do some long distance bicycle riding, and there are times when my sugar gets low, and I can usually recognize that and usually treat it on my own. But I'm excited about the idea that because of the wireless connectivity that's out there, maybe I can get my insulin pump to interface with my smartphone, and then if my blood sugar levels from my continuous glucose system, my monitoring system, gets too low, it can text my wife, you know, and she can know that here's what's going on with my insulin pump. So I think it's a two-way street. I'm not so worried about the hacker piece of that because I think safety in numbers and the fact that I don't think anybody wants to kill me with insulin is a big deal. But I do like the fact that means that communication could work in a way that's really, really helpful for me and maybe wake my wife up in the middle of the night when my blood sugars are getting too low so that she can help me out.
Well, or even use that technology to alter the flow, right?
Absolutely. Or, you know, send reports to my doctor. Maybe the morning my iPhone knows that I've got an appointment and the app knows that and it just goes ahead and trucks the data on over to my doc. So when I show up, he knows what my trends and levels and you know, glucose stuff has been. So I'm encouraged. I'm looking for that stuff. Not the death by insulin part.
Right. Positive uses. That's why I looked at it.
Yep.
Claims are currently being accepted in the Wells Fargo settlement. Basically, they claim some discrimination against folks needing TTY services or accessible documents and so forth. So I want to ask either of you if you know, have you either had personal issues dealing with banking and financial institutions or know of others who have and have really had difficulty just trying to connect their financial transactions?
For me personally, I think, you know, banks and other financial industries have been a microcosm of the positives and negatives that we see with accessibility in general. Things have gotten somewhat better, but I know even today, some of the financial institutions where I conduct my business, There's services they offer that are either very tedious to use because of accessibility problems or outright impossible. That's kind of a microcosm of how accessibility is in general.
Yeah, and I would agree. I think there's a big awareness issue there. We operate a low-interest loan program for assistive technology in Indiana, and we've got a banking partner who's great. I can get him to do anything I need to coordinate and help promote and help approve loans and things like that. What I can't do is get from them an application that's not a scanned in image. I can't get it in an accessible PDF. I can't get it in text and those kind of things. And we have recreated the form in a way that's accessible. But with this particular bank, they just don't get it. They just don't understand. Well, they said, well, we send it to you electronically. We scanned it in and here's your TIFF file. They just don't get it. So I think that's an awareness piece.
I mean, I think most larger financial organizations have probably heard of accessibility. It's like moving a big ship. Getting the organization to change takes time. I know one organization I've dealt with over the years, and I mean, I actually know some of the people that work in the business, and they will agree with me that yes, these things are not possible, and it's a matter of getting the commitment outside of them to spend resources on fixing them.
Yeah, you're listening to This Month in Access Technology for August 2011. Another issue was had to do with the court ruling that airport kiosks do not need to be accessible, and of equal or greater concern is that the websites do not either, which always throws me back to the question, what constitutes web accessibility? If it works with JAWS, if it works with Mac and Voice over Safari, or two out of the three perceived top screen readers? I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think they took an interesting legal approach, by basically saying that the department, I'm not a lawyer, obviously, but, where they got some federal law to trump the state law, I believe they said, if the feds had wanted accessibility, they should have called it out clearly. As an individual, that's kind of a disappointment.
Right. They were trying to get California state law to trump federal law.
I'm sure the companies thought, hey, wow, this is, pretty brilliant legal strategy.
Yeah, it was worth a shot, I suppose. We're going to enable questions here and see in the last few minutes if there's any questions from the folks who are attending this evening. But what are your thoughts on this one? We had Deanna Jones was a law student, and they're saying, no, we don't have to allow you to take your tests via the computer. It's perfectly okay to give you a reader. Wade, how much of this are you seeing? Just issues that students have to deal with? And obviously now, even in high school, if they're rolling out iPads, but college and graduate students and folks just wanting to be able to take tests like everyone else.
I think it's like everything else with assistive technology and accessibility. I think it's very, very inconsistent. Education happens in the classroom and at the local level, and I would love to tell you that I'm seeing all kinds of trends there, but really on that kind of stuff, it boils down to the teacher, the student, and the other forces at play. So I'm not seeing anything consistent there.
I think to me, what is frustrating is if you are accustomed to demonstrating your knowledge in a certain way, you've seen this at different times where they've said, you can't use a screen reader or whatever to take these standardized tests. We'll have a reader for you. Well, if you're accustomed to using a computer, the dynamics of having someone read something to you are very different. And I think it puts you at a huge disadvantage to demonstrate your abilities. And
yeah, test I had to take in college where I had to match two columns of 50 items. And that wasn't the easiest thing to do with a reader. I don't know how common that kind of scenario is, but it certainly is one example where maybe you're hands-on.
But, I mean, it's funny you say that. I recall taking essay exams in college on a typewriter where, I couldn't. This was dating myself a little bit, but at that time, screen readers were just on the infancy if they even existed in some arenas. And, I mean, I remember I used to go into this assistant's office and type out essay exams on a typewriter.
Oh, yeah. I was there. Smith Corona. And I hope I caught when I made a mistake and backspace and put the correction tape in there and had to turn the thing in, assuming I've got it right. I had an Opticon, finally. But, and I don't know if people like us who did things that way are less empathetic, sympathetic to what folks deal with today. They're different issues because, you know, my first inclination is, wow, you guys got it easy.
Is that an I walk to school in the snow uphill both ways kind of situation?
Exactly.
You know, one
of Corona. Yeah. It was interesting for me having then worked in an academic setting, being responsible to try and make sure that, you know, that college was accessible. It took away any notions of, hey, I had it better because, you know, those students were dealing with different challenges. You know, half the time applications or even a lot of this learning curriculum stuff, you know, we had a struggle just to even make it work with the screen reader as an example or other AT. So,
well, and you know, one of the concepts that comes up kind of routinely as we teach special ed teachers is the concept of differentiated instruction and that, you know, kids need to be taught differently. You need to go to the kid and help them learn the way they learn. And funny enough, the high incidence of kids with learning disabilities and autism and those kind of things are starting to wake teachers up a little bit to those needs and the fact that you just can't stand in front of the chalkboard and make notes and lecture. You've got to bend and change to match the needs of the students. And, you know, some of the needs that a kid with dyslexia is going to have is similar to a kid with learning with a vision impairment, you know, speech out and stuff like that. So I think that the whole idea of meet the student where they are, do the best you can to make sure that they're learning the content is the important thing. And the tools that you use to go about it, you know, is a different thing altogether. And then that brings up the topic of who's going to be the expert on how to, you know, do a tactile representation of columnar data for a physics class or something like that. But it's improving, I hope to say anyway.
The other thing I think that
we had a question here asking about saying, I heard that Facebook has hired an accessibility specialist. Do you know anything about that? And all I can say is I saw the ad looking for someone and what it actually means. Your guess is as good as mine. Sorry, go ahead, Kelly.
I was going to just say one other thing on the topic about differentiation. But in answer to Facebook, I've seen the same ad but don't know anything more. But the other thing I think it's important for just people to make sure that education and everybody understands is, you know, people with disabilities are people first. And just because one blind student, you know, or pick any other disability, learned in this way or was good at these subjects doesn't mean everybody is. I remember being in school, and this was, quote, mainstream, but long story short, there was a few other blind people, and we were all very different academically. And I remember how disappointing it was to see the teachers not be able to understand that, you know, not every student was going to be a rock star academically. And that should have been okay.
There were two stories, one saying a bionic eye has come to market in Europe. Another one talking about looking for some volunteers, people ready to play around with this BrainPort technology that uses your tongue to send visual messages to the cortex of your brain. Wade, I'm just curious from your perspective, is it a real obstacle for you that people holding on to this either false hope or just some chance that they'll get some form of vision and just preventing it from letting them grow and develop and have a quality life or go out and seek some kind of career?
Well, I think this technology is probably generally designed by sighted people or people who lost their vision later in life and they're looking to repair that kind of stuff. I'm fascinated by the technology. I think the whole the lollipop stimulation thing on your tongue that gives you some sort of representation of what the visual image is exciting. I think that technology is going to help us in a lot of ways, and I would never want to, you know, stifle development in those areas. I just hope that when people are looking toward that kind of stuff, they're not, you know, avoiding trying to figure out how to, you know, be independent in the meantime and use the tools that are out there and that that are already available that, you know, provide access to information. So I don't know, but it's kind of cool Star Trek-y kind of stuff. I like to keep an eye on it.
It's funny that you bring that up. I used a precursor of that very technology.
Was it an Opticon?
Well, so I used that, but also before they were doing this, there's been a few different people involved in this research, and they've tried various techniques. One technique, this is just, you know, as the technology was evolving, was they would actually transmit through low-level electrical stimulation visual images onto your stomach.
Really?
And I used to make beer money in college to go be one of their experimental guinea pigs. So I would walk around with a helmet and a camera and, like, follow lines and find doors and, you know, have to walk up to a line all by feeling this transmitted onto through electrical stimulation onto my stomach.
Kelly, my question is, did they have to continually increase the size of the thing on your stomach with the beer money?
No, not then.
Well, we had a few other topics here. There was all kinds of good stuff. I would encourage folks to look at our show notes. I don't know, Wade, if you played with this, something called a camera mouse that basically tracks your head movement. So if you have a webcam installed, you can use it. I'm just curious. Obviously, it wasn't designed for the blind, but maybe if this could be a tool to better navigate and manipulate the mouse. We also have an article here of a really cool mobile application for folks with diabetes to actually help people keep records, kind of keep a log of their doses and so forth. There's a Raspberry Pi $25 computer coming out running TLS 2.0, and I don't know if that can be made to talk or what's going on there. But those are just a few of many stories we have over here on the show notes page that folks can check out. I want to thank both of you for joining us this evening, and I'll give you guys a chance for final comments. First, I want to invite folks to join us in 2 weeks on September 22nd. And announce it here first that these events will be bi-weekly, at least for now. And the Serial Talk podcast will be going to a weekly format so that folks can get their AT news as soon as possible. And that way we don't have to feed you 50 minutes every 2 weeks. We can cut it down to about 25 and do some product reviews. So we're very excited about that. And of course, as always, after these Thursday evening presentations, you can come over to the SAMNet Tech chat room and talk with other folks of SAMNet. If you haven't played around with it, you can get a free 7-day trial over at satogo.com. That's satogo.com. And we invite you to be checking in to serotalk.com. Other changes, we have a new podcast called EOL or End of Line. A few other shows in the not-too-distant future. So let me just take final comments, or please, each of you guys, I'll start with you, Wade, give your contact information where folks can check out your website and podcast and so forth.
Yeah, Mike and Kelly, thanks so much for allowing me to sit in on my inaugural run with the show tonight. It's been a lot of fun. Folks, check us out at easterseals.tech.com or hit me up on Twitter at indataproject. We'd love to hear from everybody.
Kelly, how can folks reach you? You have kellyford.org?
Yeah, so Wade, Michael, and Jeff, who left us, you know, it's been a treat to do this. I've enjoyed it. You can reach me at kellyford.org or on Twitter at Kelly, K-E-L-L-Y-L, Ford. The two best ways to get a hold of me.
Okay, I thank both of you guys, and we invite you to stay tuned to serotalk.com. A lot of exciting new stuff coming down the line. And with that, we'll put the wraps on it. And again, give us your suggestions. Which of the three names for the tech chat do you like? We'd like to hear from you. And we have them here on the website. Minds That Mesh, Serospective, and where's the other one here? There it is. Digital Dimensions. Which of those three names do you like? Help us name the show to best describe the variety of different content and interactive discussion that we give to you. So with that, we're going to put the wraps on it. Thank you for joining us. And until we meet again, let's stay connected and stay directed.
Reading of speech.
For all speech synthesizers.
This is the Serotalk Podcast Network.
Comments made on the Serotalk Podcast Network are those of the individuals and do not represent Serotech Corporation, its staff, management, board of directors, or third-party reseller.